Rincewind headed on towards the hill. Random as the animal tracks and occasional plank bridges were, they seemed to head right for it. If Rincewind had been thinking clearly, an activity he last remembered doing around the age of 12, he might have wondered about that. The trees of the lower slopes were sapient pears, and he didn't even think about that. Their leaves turned to watch him as he scrambled past. What he needed now was a cave, or a handy... He paused. "Oh, no," he said. "No, no, no, you don't catch me like that. I'll go into a handy cave, and there'll be a little door or some wise old man or something, and I'll be dragged back into events. Right. Stay out in the open. That's the style." He half-climbed, half-walked to the rounded top of the hill, which rose above the trees like a dome. Now he was closer. He could see that it wasn't as smooth as it looked from below. Weather had worn gullies and channels in the soil, and bushes had colonised every sheltered slope. The building on the top was, to Rincewind's surprise, rusty. It had been made of iron, pointed iron roof, iron walls, iron doorway. There were a few old nests and some debris on the floor, but it was otherwise empty, and not a good place to hide. It would be the first place anyone would look. There was a cloud wall around the world now. Lightning crackled in its heart, and there was the sound of thunder, not the gentle rumble of summer thunder, but the crack, crack, crack of splitting sky. And yet the heat wrapped the plain like a blanket. The air felt thick. In a minute it was going to rain cats and food. "Find somewhere where I won't be noticed," he muttered. "Keep head down, only way. Why should I care? Other people's problem." Panting in the oppressive heat, he wandered on. Lord Hong was enraged. Those who knew him could tell by the way he spoke more slowly and smiled continuously.
"And how do the men know the lightning dragons are angry?" he said. "It may be mere high spirits."
"Not with a sky that colour," said Lord Tang. "That is not an auspicious colour for a sky. It looks like a bruise. A sky like that is portentous."
"And what, pray, do you think it portends?"
"It's just generally portentous."
"I know what's behind this," Lord Hong snarled. "You're too frightened to fight seven old men, is that it?"
"The men say they're the legendary seven indestructible sages," said Lord Fang. He tried to smile. "You know how superstitious they are."
"What seven sages?" said Lord Hong. "I am extremely familiar with the history of the world, and there are no legendary seven indestructible sages."
"Not yet," said Lord Fang. "But a day like this, perhaps legends have to start somewhere."
"The barbarians! Oh, gods! Seven men! Can I believe we're afraid of seven men?"
"It feels wrong," said Lord McSweeney. He added quickly, "That's what the men say."
"You have made the proclamation about our celestial army of ghosts, all of you?"
The warlords tried to avoid his gaze.
Yes, said Lord Fang.
"That must have improved morale."
Not entirely.
"What do you mean, man?"
Many men have deserted. They've been saying that foreign ghosts were bad enough, but...
But what?
"They are soldiers, Lord Hong," said Lord Tang sharply. "They all have people they do not want to meet, don't you?"
Just for a second, there was the suggestion of a twitch on Lord Hong's cheek. It was only for a second, but those who saw it took note. Lord Hong's renowned glaze had shown a crack.
"What would you do, Lord Tang? Let these insolent barbarians go?"
"Of course not, but you don't need an army against seven men. Seven ancient old men. The peasants say... They say..."
Lord Hong's voice was slightly higher.
"Come on, man. Who talks to peasants? I'm sure you're going to tell us what they say about these foolhardy and foolish old men."
"Well, that's it, you see. They say if they're so foolish and foolhardy, how did they manage to become so old?"
"Luck."
It was the wrong word. Even Lord Hong realized it. He'd never believed in luck. He'd always taken pains, usually those of other people, to fill life with certainties. But he knew that others believed in luck. It was a foible he'd always been happy to make use of. And now it was turning and stinging him on the hand.
"There is nothing in the art of war to tell us how 5 armies attack 7 old men," said Lord Tang. "Ghosts or no ghosts. And this, Lord Hong, is because no one ever thought such a thing would be done."
"If you feel so frightened, I'll ride out against them with my mere 250,000 men," he said.
"I'm not frightened," said Lord Tang. "I am ashamed."
"Each man armed with 2 swords," Lord Hong went on, ignoring him, "and I shall see how lucky these sages are, because, my lords, I will only have to be lucky once. They will all have to be lucky 250,000 times."
He lowered his visor.
"How lucky do you feel, my lords?"
The other 4 warlords avoided one another's gaze. Lord Hong noticed their resigned silence.
"Very well, then," he said. "Let the gongs be sounded and the firecrackers lit, to ensure good luck, of course."
There were a large number of ranks in the armies of the Empire, and many of them were untranslatable. 3 Pink Pig and 5 White Fang were, loosely speaking, privates, and not just because they were pale, vulnerable, and inclined to curl up and hide when danger threatened. In fact, they were so private as to be downright secretive. Even the army's mules ranked higher than them, because good mules were hard to come by, whereas men like Pink Pig and White Fang are found in every army, somewhere where a latrine is in need of cleaning. They were so insignificant that they had privately decided that it would be a waste of an invisible foreign blood-sucking ghost's valuable time to attack them. They felt it only fair, after it had come all this way, to give it the chance of fiendishly killing someone superior. They had therefore hospitably decamped just before dawn and were now hiding out. Of course, if victory threatened, they could always recamp. It was unlikely that they'd be missed in all the excitement, and both men were somewhat expert at turning up on battlefields in time to join in the victory celebrations. They lay in the long grass, watching the armies manoeuvre. From this height, it looked like an impressive war. The army on one side was so small as to be invisible. Of course, if you accepted the very strong denials of last night, it was so invisible as to be invisible. It was also their elevation, which meant that they were the first to notice the ring around the sky. It was just above the thunderous wall on the horizon. Where stray shafts of sunlight hit it, it glowed golden. Elsewhere, it was merely yellow, but it was continuous and thin as a thread.
"Funny-looking cloud," said White Fang. "Yeah," said Pink Pig. "So what?"
It was while they were thus engaged and sharing a small bottle of rice wine, liberated by Pink Pig from an unsuspecting comrade the previous evening, that they heard a groan.
"Oh!"
Their drinks froze in their throats.
"Did you hear that?" said Pink Pig.
"You mean the... Oh!"
"That's it."
They turned very slowly. Something had pulled itself out of a gully behind them. It was humanoid, more or less. Red mud dripped from it. Strange noises issued from its mouth.
"Oh, shit!"
Pink Pig grabbed White Fang's arm.
"It's an invisible blood-sucking ghost!"
"But I can see it."
Pink Pig squinted.
"It's the Red Army. They've come up out of the earth like everybody says."
White Fang, who had several brain cells more than Pink Pig, and more importantly was only on his second cup of wine, took a closer look.
"It could be just one ordinary man with mud all over him," he suggested.
He raised his voice.
"Hey, you!"
The figure turned and tried to run. Pink Pig nudged his friend.
"Is he one of ours? Looking like that?" "Let's get him."
"Why?"
"'Cause he's running away."
"Let him run.
Maybe he's got money. Anyway, what's he running away for?"
Rincewind slid down into another gully. Of all the luck, soldiers should be where they were expected to be. What had happened to duty and honour and stuff like that? The gully had dead grass and moss in the bottom. He stood still and listened to the voices of the 2 men. The air was stifling. It was as if the oncoming storm was pushing all the hot air in front of it, turning the plane into a pressure cooker. And then the ground creaked and sagged suddenly. the faces of the absentee soldiers appeared over the edge of the gully. There was another creak, and the ground sank another inch or two. Rincewind didn't dare breathe in case the extra weight of air made him too heavy, and it was very clear that the least activity, such as jumping, was going to make things worse. Very carefully, he looked down. The dead moss had given away. He seemed to be standing on a bulk of timber buried in the ground, but dirt pouring all around it suggested that there was a hole beneath. It was going to give way any second. Rincewind threw himself forward. The ground fell away underneath, so that instead of standing on a slowly breaking piece of timber, he was hanging with his arms over what felt like another concealed log, and by the feel of it, one which was as riddled with rot as the first one. This one, possibly out of a desire to conform, began to sag, and then jolted to a stop. The faces of the soldiers vanished backwards as the sides of the gully began to slide. Dry earth and small stones slid past Rincewind. He could feel them rattle on his boots and drop away. He felt, as an expert in these things, that he was over a depth. From his point of view, it was also a height. The log began to shift again. This left Rincewind with, as he saw it, two options. He could let go and plunge to an uncertain fate in the darkness, or he could hang on until the timber gave way and then plunge to an uncertain fate in the darkness. And then, to his delight, there was a third option. The toe of his boot touched something, a root, a protruding rock, it didn't matter. It took some of his weight. It took at least enough to put him in precarious equilibrium, not exactly safe, not exactly falling. Of course, it was only a temporary measure, but Rincewind had always considered that life was no more than a series of temporary measures strung together. A pale yellow butterfly, with interesting patterns on its wing, fluttered along the gully and settled on the only bit of colour available, which turned out to be Rincewind's hat. The wood sagged slightly.
"Push off,"
said Rincewind, trying not to use heavy language.
"Go away."
The butterfly flattened its wings and sunned itself. Rincewind pursed his lips and tried to blow up his own nostrils. Startled, the creature skittered into the air.
"Ha!" said Rincewind.
And, in response to its instincts in the face of threat, moved its wings like this, this. The bushes shivered, and around the sky the towering clouds curved into unusual patterns. Another cloud formed. It was about the size of an angry grey balloon, and it started to rain. Not rain generally, but specifically. Specifically on about a square foot of ground, which contained Rincewind. Specifically on his hat. A very small bolt of lightning stung Rincewind on the nose.
"Ah, so we have..."
Pink Pig, appearing round the curve of the gully, hesitated a bit before continuing, slightly more thoughtfully,
"a head in a hole, with a very small thunderstorm above it."
And then it dawned on him that, storm or no storm, nothing was preventing him from cutting off significant parts. The only significant part available was a head, but that was fine by him. At which point, Rincewind's hat having absorbed enough moisture, the ancient wood gave way under the strain and plunged him to an uncertain fate in the darkness. It was utterly dark. There had been a painful confusion of tunnels and sliding dirt. Rincewind assumed, or the small part of him that was not sobbing with fear assumed, that the earth had caved in after him. Cave. That was a significant word. He was in a cave. Reaching out carefully in case he felt for something to feel. There was a straight edge. It led to three more straight edges going off at right angles. So, this meant slab. The darkness was still a choking velvet shroud. Slab meant that there was some other entrance, some proper entrance. Even now, guards were probably hurrying towards him. Perhaps the luggage was hurrying towards them. It had been acting very funny lately, that was for certain. He was probably better off without it. Probably. He patted his pockets, saying the mantra that even non-wizards invoke in order to find matches. That is, he said, "Matches, matches, matches," madly to himself under his breath. He found some and scratched one desperately with his thumbnail.
Ow!
The smoky yellow flame lit nothing except Rincewind's hand and part of his sleeve. He ventured a few steps before it burned his fingers, and when it did, it left a blue afterglow in the darkness of his vision. There were no sounds of vengeful feet. There were no sounds at all. In theory, there should be the drip of water, but the air felt quite dry. He tried another match, and this time raised it as high as he could and peered ahead. A 7-foot warrior smiled at him. Cohen looked up again.
"It's going to piss down in a minute," he said. "Will you look at that sky?"
There were hints of purple and red in the mass, and the occasional momentary glow of lightning somewhere inside the clouds.
"Teach?"
"Yes?"
"You know everything. Why is that cloud looking like that?"
Mr. Savaloy looked where Cohen was pointing. There was a yellowish cloud low on the horizon. Right around the horizon, one thin streak, as though the sun was trying to find a way through.
"Could be the lining,"
said Boy Willie.
"What lining? Every cloud's supposed to have a silver one." "Yeah, but that's more like gold." "Well, gold's cheaper here."
"Is it me," said Mr. Savaloy, "or is it getting wider?"
Caleb was staring at the enemy lines.
"There's been a lot of blokes galloping about on their little horses," he said. "I hope they get a move on. We don't want to be here all day."
"I vote we rushes them while they're not expecting it," said Hamish.
"Hold on, hold on," said Truckle.
It was the sound of many gongs being beaten and the cracking of fireworks. "Looks like the love childs are moving."
"Thank goodness for that," said Cohen.
He stood up and stubbed out his cigarette. Mr. Savaloy trembled with excitement.
"Do we sing a song for the gods before we go into battle?" he said.
"You can if you like," said Cohen.
"Well, do we say any heathen chants or prayers?"
"Shouldn't think so," said Cohen. He glanced up at the horizon-girdling band. It was unsettling him far more than the approaching enemy. It was wider now, but slightly paler. For just a moment he found himself wishing that there was one god or goddess somewhere whose temple he hadn't violated, robbed, or burned down.
"Don't we bang our swords on our shields and utter defiance?" said the teacher, hopefully.
"Too late for that, really," said Cohen.
Mr. Savaloy looked so crestfallen at the lack of pagan splendour that the ancient barbarian was, to his own surprise, moved to add,
"But feel free, if that's what you want."
The horde drew their various swords. In Hamish's case, another axe was produced from under his rug.
"See you in heaven," said Mr. Savaloy excitedly.
"Yeah, right," said Caleb, eyeing the line of approaching soldiers.
"Where there's feasting and young ladies and so forth."
"Yeah, yeah,"
said Boy Willie, testing the blade of his sword.
"And carousing and quaffing, I believe."
"Could be,"
said Vincent, trying to ease the tendinitis in his arm.
"And we'll do that thing, you know, where you throw the axes and cut ladies' plaits off."
"Yeah, if you like."
"But what?"
"The actual feasting. Do they do anything vegetarian?"
And the advancing army screamed and charged. They rushed at the horde almost as fast as the clouds boiling in from every direction. Rincewind's brain unfroze slowly in the darkness and silence of the hill.
"It's a statue," he told himself. "That's all it is. No problem there. Not even a particularly good one. Just a big statue of a man in armour.
Look, there's a couple more. You can just see them at the edge of the light.
Ow!"
He dropped the match and sucked his fingers. What he needed now was a wall. Walls had exits. True, they could also be entrances, but now there didn't seem much danger of any guards hurrying in here. The air had an ancient smell, with a hint of fox and a slight trace of thunderstorms. But above all, it tasted unused. He crept forward, testing each step with his foot. Then there was light. A small blue spark jumped off Rincewind's finger. Cohen grabbed at his beard. It was straining away from his face. Mr. Savaloy's fringe of hair stood out from his head and sparked at the ends.
"Static discharges!"
he shouted above the crackle. Ahead of them, the spears of the enemy glowed at the tips. The charge faltered. There was the occasional shriek as sparks leapt from man to man. Cohen looked up.
"Oh, my," he said. "Will you look at that?"
Tiny sparks flickered around Rincewind as he eased himself over the unseen floor. The word tomb had presented itself for his consideration, and one thing Rincewind knew about large tombs was that their builders were often jolly inventive in the traps and spikes department. They also put in things like paintings and statues, possibly so that the dead had something to look at if they became bored. Rincewind's hand touched stone, and he moved carefully sideways. Now and again his feet touched something yielding and soft. He very much hoped it was mud. And then, right at hand height, was a lever. It stuck out fully 2 feet. Now, it could be a trap, but traps were generally, well, traps. The first you knew about them was when your head was rolling along the corridor several yards away. And trap builders tended to be straightforwardly homicidal and seldom required victims to actively participate in their own destruction. Rincewind pulled it. The yellow cloud sailed overhead in its millions, moving much faster on the wind they'd created than the slow beating of their wings would suggest. Behind them came the storm. Mr. Savaloy blinked. Butterflies? Both sides stopped as the creatures sleeted past. It was even possible to hear the rustle of their wings.
All right, Teach, said Cohen. Explain this one. It could be a natural phenomenon, said Mr. Savaloy. Monarch butterflies, for example, have been known to tell you the truth, I don't know.
The cloud swarmed on towards the hill.
Not some kind of sign, said Cohen. There must have been some temple I didn't rob. The trouble with signs and portents, said Boy Willie, is you never know who they're for. This one could be a nice one for Hong and his pals.
Then I'm nicking it, said Cohen.
You can't steal a message from the gods, said Mr. Savaloy.
Can you see it nailed down anywhere?
No? Sure. Right. So it's mine.
He raised his sword as the stragglers fluttered past overhead.
The gods smile on us, he bellowed. Ha 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 ha!
Ha 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 ha, whispered Mr. Savaloy.
Just to worry him, said Cohen.
He glanced at the other members of the horde. Each man nodded very slightly.
All right, lads, he said quietly. This is it.
What do I do? Said Mr. Savaloy.
Think of something to make yourself good and angry. That gets the old blood boiling. Imagine the enemy is everything you hate.
Head teachers, said Mr. Savaloy.
Good.
Sports masters, shouted Mr. Savaloy.
Yep.
Boys who chew gum, screamed Mr. Savaloy.
Look at him. Steam coming out of his ears already, said Cohen.
First one to the afterlife gets him in.
Charge!
The yellow cloud thronged up the slopes of the hill and then, carried on the uprising wind, rose. Above it, the storm rose too, piling up and up and spreading into a shape something like a hammer. It struck. Lightning hit the iron pagoda so hard that it exploded into white-hot fragments. It is confusing for an entire army to be attacked by 7 old men. No book of tactics is up to the task of offering advice. There is a tendency towards bafflement. The soldiers backed away in the face of the rush and then, driven by currents in the great mass of men, closed in behind. A solid circle of shields surrounded the horde. It buckled and swayed under the press of men and also under the blows rained on it by Mr. Savaloy's sword.
"Come on, fight!" he shouted. "Smoke pipes at me, would you? You, that boy there, answer me back, eh? Take that!"
Cohen looked at Caleb, who shrugged. He'd seen berserk rages in his time, but nothing quite so incandescent as Mr. Savaloy. The circle broke as a couple of men tried to dart backwards and cannoned into the rank behind and then rebounded onto the swords of the horde. One of Hamish's wheels caught a soldier with a vicious blow on the knee, and as he bent over, one of Hamish's axes met him coming the other way. It wasn't speed. The horde couldn't move very fast, but it was economy. Mr. Savaloy had remarked on it. They were simply always where they wanted to be, which was never where somebody's sword was. They let everyone else do the running around. A soldier would risk a slash in the direction of Truckle and find Cohen rising in front of him, grinning and swinging, or Boy Willie giving him a nod of acknowledgement and a stab. Occasionally, one of the horde took time to parry a blow aimed at Mr. Savaloy, who was far too excited to defend himself.
"Pull back, you bloody fools!"
Lord Hong appeared behind the throng, his horse rearing, his helmet visor flung back. The soldiers tried to obey. Finally, the press eased a little and then opened. The horde were left in a widening ring of shields. There was something like silence, broken only by the endless thunder and the crackle of lightning on the hill. And then, pushing their way angrily through the soldiers, came an altogether different breed of warrior. They were taller and heavier armoured, with splendid helmets and moustaches that looked like a declaration of war in themselves. One of them glared at Cohen.
"What's that?" said Cohen.
"He's a samurai," said Mr. Savaloy, wiping his forehead. "The warrior caste. I think that's their formal challenge. Would you like me to fight him?" One samurai glared at Cohen. He pulled a scrap of silk out of his armour and tossed it into the air. The other hand grabbed the hilt of his long, thin sword. There was hardly even a hiss, but three shreds of silk tumbled gently to the ground.
"Get back, Teach," said Cohen slowly. "I reckon this one's mine. Got another hanky?" "Thanks."
The samurai looked at Cohen's sword. It was long, heavy, and had so many notches in it it could have been used as a saw.
"You'll never do it," he said, "with that sword. Never."
Cohen blew his nose noisily.
"You say," he said. "Watch this."
The handkerchief soared into the air. Cohen gripped his sword. He'd beheaded three upward-staring samurai before the handkerchief started to tumble. Other members of the horde, who tended to think in much the same way as their leader, had accounted for half a dozen more.
"Got the idea from Caleb," said Cohen. "And the message is, either fight or muck about. It's up to you."
"Have you no honour?"
screamed Lord Hong.
"Are you just a ruffian?"
"I'm a barbarian," shouted Cohen. "And the honour I got, see, is mine. I didn't steal it off someone else."
"I had wanted to take you alive," said Lord Hong. "However, I see no reason to stick to this policy."
He drew his sword.
"Back, you scum," he screamed. "Right back. Let the bombardiers come forward."
He looked back at Cohen. His face was flushed. His spectacles were askew. Lord Hong had lost his temper. And as is always the case when a dam bursts, it engulfs whole countries. The soldiers pulled back. The horde were, once again, in a widening circle.
"What's a bombardier?"
said Boy Willie.
I believe it must mean people who fire some sort of projectile," said Mr. Savaloy. "The word derives from..."
"Oh, archers," said Boy Willie, and spat.
"What?" said Mad Hamish.
"He said they're going to use archers, Hamish."
"We never let archers stop us at the Battle of Coombe Valley,"
cackled the antique barbarian.
Boy Willie sighed.
"That was between dwarfs and trolls, Hamish," he said, "and you ain't either. So whose side were you on?"
"What?"
"I said, whose side were you on?"
"I were on the side of being paid money to fight," said Hamish.
"Best side there is,"